Obama says goodbye, the press gets baited, the cabinet nominees get grilled, and is Meryl Streep overrated? Poetry in motion on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President-elect Trump held his first press conference since the election, and guess what? He's still in campaign mode.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, I consider that an asset, not a liability. Do you honestly believe that Hillary would be tougher on Putin than me? Does anybody in this room really believe that? Give me a break.
Plus, did President Obama hit all the right notes in his farewell address?
No question about it. And Barack Obama inhabited the role of president as much as any president has. This was a rally, and it was less a farewell address than a see you later address.
And we'll recall one of the most famous presidential farewells of all time.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 161 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Not that there's been any normalcy in politics this past year and a half, but this week has been unbelievable. The beginning of Senate confirmation hearings for the Trump cabinet, the farewell speech of President Obama, and the first Trump press conference since the election, the first since July, in fact. We'll try to catch our breath for this week's show. This week actually started out 2,680-some-odd miles away from Washington with further escalation of another partisan feud, this one between Hollywood and the president-elect. On Sunday, the Golden Globes, that's the awards show by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, gave a Lifetime Achievement Award to actress Meryl Streep, and she had this to say.
It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter, someone he outranked in privilege, power, and the capacity to fight back. It kind of broke my heart when I saw it, and I still can't get it out of my head because it wasn't in a movie. It was real life. And this instinct to humiliate when it's modeled by someone in the public platform, by someone powerful. It filters down into everybody's life because it kind of gives permission for other people to do the same thing. Disrespect invites disrespect. Violence incites violence. When the powerful use their position to bully others, we all lose.
Well, of course, that was not the end of it. Donald Trump, who was never mentioned by name in Streep's remarks, quickly tweeted, quote, Meryl Streep, one of the most overrated actresses in Hollywood, doesn't know me, but attacked last night at the Golden Globes. She is a Hillary flunky who lost big. He went on to say, or to tweet, for the 100th time, I never mocked a disabled reporter, would never do that, but simply showed him groveling when he totally changed a 16-year-old story that he had written in order to make me look bad. Just more very dishonest media. And Trump aide Kellyanne Conway had this on Fox and Friends.
I'm glad that Meryl Streep has such a passion for the disabled because I didn't hear her weigh in, and I didn't hear her even use her platform last night, Ainsley, to give a shout-out to the mentally challenged boy who last week was tortured live on Facebook for half an hour by four young African-American adults who were screaming racial and anti-Trump expletives and forcing him to put his head in toilet water.
Because the actions of four young African-American adults are comparable to the president-elect of the United States. Yep. Anyway, as with any conversation involving Trump and tweet, this took on a life of its own. Social media was flooded with comments supporting Streep and supporting Trump. Stephen Colbert responded on CBS's Late Show this way.
Look, Mr. Trump, you can refuse to release your taxes. You can call to ban an entire religion. You can play footsie with a dictator, but calling Meryl Streep overrated? No.
No. But not everyone felt the same way. Jack Schaefer, the media reporter for Politico, wondered how much courage it took for her to take on Trump. "There Streep was," he wrote, "gazing over a sea of designer gowns and fashionable tuxedos, addressing the most condensed mass of liberal groupthink since students returned to Oberlin College earlier this month after winter break. Almost to a one, Hollywood hates Trump as much as it loved Hillary Clinton, and attacking him constitutes the highest form of self-congratulation," end quote. That debate will not end anytime soon. Our trivia question this week combines the Golden Globes with politics. One of the nominees this year for Best Actress in a Motion Picture, for drama, was Natalie Portman, who portrayed First Lady Jackie Kennedy. What actress played the last politician to win that award? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Movie 8 till the wedding day, shots rang out. The police came, Mama laid me on the front lawn and prayed for Jackie's strength.
We'll start unpacking the week's news with President-elect Trump's press conference. It was held at Trump Tower in Manhattan, a freewheeling affair that included attacks on the dishonest media, as well as the jab at our intelligence agencies, news about his businesses, the wall in Mexico, the timetable for a Supreme Court nominee, life after Obamacare, and much more. Janet Hook of the Wall Street Journal is here to make sense of it all. Lots of luck with that, Janet. Janet, great to have you on the program.
False advertising. I can't make sense of this, but I'm happy to talk to you about it.
Well, I appreciate it, and I'm trying to think of where I begin. I guess I begin... And what was probably the elephant in the room was that report from BuzzFeed overnight and later repeated on CNN about alleged personal and financial information Russia has on Donald Trump. Explain what that's all about.
Right. Well, that was this huge bombshell that dropped last night that became the centerpiece of many of the questions that were put to him. I mean, what had happened was there was a kind of an opposition research document that had been compiled months ago that contained these very explosive allegations about Russia having personal and professional information about Trump that they could use to blackmail him. And it had been kind of circulating around. People hadn't been able to verify it, reporters who had their hands on it. But apparently during the intelligence briefings that were given to Trump and President Obama last week, the intelligence agencies included a two-page summary of those memos just to kind of make sure that Trump knew that this stuff was out there. Anyway, that then, of course, leaked out, and CNN reported that the memos were there and part of the briefing, but BuzzFeed controversially printed the text of the entire memo, including these claims that hadn't been substantiated. So inevitably, I mean, as if we didn't have enough to ask Donald Trump about at this press conference, this just became something that had to be put out there. And they addressed it front, you know, head on at the beginning, even before Trump came out. They had White House to be spokesman Sean Spicer come out and deride the media for putting it out there. Trump then kind of praised the media who were more restrained with it. But anyway, so it was like the first topic number one at the press conference.
I was going to say, and he was on Trump was on the warpath over this story, and he let everyone know it.
I will say again, I think it's a disgrace that information would be let out. I saw the information. I read the information outside of that meeting. It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen. And it was gotten by opponents of ours, as you know, because you reported it, and so did many of the other people. It was a group of opponents that got together, sick people, and they put that crap together. So I will tell you that not within the meeting, but outside of the meeting, somebody released it. It should never have been, number one, shouldn't have even entered paper, but it should never have been released. But I read what was released, and I think it's a disgrace. I think it's an absolute disgrace.
I thought what most interesting, Janet, about that was that he said it might have been released by the intelligence agencies. His war with the intelligence agencies has not gone away.
Right. I mean, he's been complaining about the intelligence agencies for weeks now. Interestingly, one of the things that he's been discrediting them about was the claim that Russia was behind the hacking of the DNC during the campaign. And one of the more newsworthy elements of the press conference today is that he did concede that it was the Russians who had hacked, or probably the Russians that had done the hacking.
Although it was interesting, when he talked about that, it all turned into a rant about Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know, President Putin and Russia put out a statement today that this fake news was indeed fake news. They said it totally never happened. Now, somebody would say, oh, of course he's going to say that. I respected the fact that he said that. And I'll be honest, I think if he did have something, they would have released it. They would have been glad to release it. I think, frankly, had they broken into the Republican National Committee, I think they would have released it just like they did about Hillary and all of the horrible things that her people, like Mr. Podesta, said about her. I mean, what he said about her was horrible. If somebody said about me what Podesta said about Hillary, I was the boss, I would have fired him immediately, or that person, because what he said about her was horrible. But remember this, we talk about the hacking, and hacking's bad, and it shouldn't be done. But look at the things that were hacked. Look at what was learned from that hacking. That Hillary Clinton got the questions to the debate and didn't report it? That's a horrible thing. That's a horrible thing. Can you imagine that if Donald Trump got the questions to the debate, it would have been the biggest story in the history of stories?
So, Jenna, let me see if I get this clear. So hacking is really bad, but wow, look at the great stuff we're getting out of it.
Yeah, right. Well, and, you know, that whole line of argument about, the getting the debate questions and John Podesta and what he said, I mean, it's kind of like he can't leave the campaign behind. I mean, we heard that over and over again during the campaign. And there was actually another thing that came up that was like Trump relitigating his grievances of the past was there was mention of Senator Lindsey Graham, who was one of the many Republican primary contestants, and he just loves to rank on Lindsey Graham. He said, oh, yeah, maybe someday he'll get to 1%. Like, let's put that behind.
Let me play that right now.
Lindsey Graham. I've been competing with him for a long time, and he's going to crack that 1% barrier one day. I didn't realize Lindsey Graham's still at it.
He never forgets a slight, does he?
He really doesn't. And, you know, it was interesting during the December when he was doing his rallies, his kind of thank you tour of the United States to thank his supporters. He often, you know, the liveliest part of every rally was always when he did the you know, let's remember how I won. Let me remind you what it was like on election night. The campaign never ends.
In addition to the campaign never ending, his attacks on the dishonest media and now fake news never ends, too. Of course, it was pro-Trump groups that were accused of fake news, you know, fake websites and all that, fake claims during the campaign. But now it seems like the Trump administration and Trump administration figures have appropriated the fake news claim.
Yeah, and there was a lot of contentiousness with the media throughout the campaign, and it's clearly going to continue. And at this press conference, there was a particularly heated exchange between Trump and Jim Acosta of CNN, because he'd been attacking CNN for putting information out about these unsubstantiated allegations. The CNN reporter tried to get recognized for a question and was kind of shouting at him, you know, can't we get a question? You've been attacking us. And Trump responded, you know, fake news, fake news. Your network is terrible. So, you know, if this is setting the tone for press relations for months to come, there's going to be a lot of fireworks.
And not only that, because it was held at Trump Tower, there were so many Trump supporters surrounding the media that it almost sounded, I mean, in a way, a part press conference and part rally.
Right. And though it probably will never be as bad as during those Trump rallies where there would be thousands of people and he would kind of basically incite them to turn to the press stand and start chanting and booing. And
I was thinking of that with the Tuesday night's Obama farewell press conference. And when Obama said that in 10 days, we're going to have a change of administration. And you heard a little booing. And then Obama said, wait a second, no booing. We're going to have a great transition. And compare that to Trump's reaction when the crowd starts yelling, lock her up, lock her up.
Yeah, it was quite a study in presidential contrast to have one night to have the Obama farewell speech, which really was trying to set a tone of, I mean, it wasn't Pollyanna-ish. In fact, it was kind of looking at all of the lingering difficulties and divisions in America. But he was like trying to be above it all and kind of get people to come together going forward. And then we get to see Trump lashing out at his critics. You couldn't see a bigger, brighter difference.
Janet, you mentioned earlier that Trump finally seemed to acknowledge that Vladimir Putin was indeed behind the hacking of the DNC. But he also, and I want to play a little piece of tape here, he also talked about his relationship with Putin and how he sees it as a good thing.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, I consider that an asset, not a liability. Because we have a horrible relationship with Russia. Russia can help us fight ISIS, which, by the way, is number one tricky. I mean, if you look, this administration created ISIS by leaving at the wrong time. The void was created. ISIS was formed. If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get along with Vladimir Putin. I hope I do. But there's a good chance I won't. And if I don't, do you honestly believe that Hillary would be tougher on Putin than me? Does anybody in this room really believe that? Give me a break.
We're back to Hillary Clinton.
Right. Right. So if ever, you know, he's in a jam, he says, you think I'm saying the wrong thing? Well, just imagine how bad it would be if Hillary was elected. Yeah. He's got this sort of stylistic quirk of periodically referring to himself in the third person like that. You know, if Putin likes Donald Trump, that's fine with me. It was interesting that in Russia, they rejected and denied the allegations that they'd been compiling information kind of to discredit Trump or others. And so then Trump tweeted it as if, well, of course, this is the most credible source on the subject. The Russians are saying they didn't do this. So I don't know. He's got a very complicated relationship with Russia, that's for sure.
The intelligence agencies are doubted, but what Putin says, well, that's gospel.
Right, right.
He actually did make some news. The president-elect did make some news in Wednesday's press conference. He did name a secretary for Veterans Affairs, right?
That's right. Trump nominated David Shulkin to be his Veterans Affairs secretary. And he's actually, interestingly, already in the Veterans Department. So he's, in essence, an Obama administration official. He's the undersecretary of health. And it's a little surprising that it took him so long to name this cabinet official, given how much he talks about veterans. And this is like classic Trump, that in the middle of other presidents might have a whole event devoted to naming this cabinet official, and he just kind of drops it in the middle of a news conference with about 10 other leads for us to follow.
He also announced that he has no dealings with Russia, he has no debt with Russia, and then he had his tax attorney talk about all these potential business conflicts. I thought that was interesting to have that in the middle of a press conference.
Well, you remember that initially, he promised in December to have a press conference to announce, to deal with how he was going to manage his business affairs in a way that would eliminate conflict of interest. So actually, the point of the press conference was supposed to be conflicts of interest and how he was handling his business. They had announced it was going to be in December, then it didn't happen. So this is basically the first press conference since he promised one. So he brought out his lawyer to explain the steps he was going to take to manage his affairs, and it doesn't go nearly as far as many ethics experts thought he would need to go, which would be to basically, you know, divest and or have all of his assets in a blind trust overseen by somebody other than his family, and that is kind of what he's ended up doing.
And then, it was interesting to say that he's going to have complete a wall between his company and his presidency. Although it was interesting, at one point he flubbed the words between country and company. He didn't know which is which. But he also had Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump right next to him, who's going to be heading up the Trump Industries.
Right. And the thing that you just can't get away from is whether somebody else is running him or not, he knows what his business interests are. And it's really hard to see that any of these protections are really going to provide any kind of airtight guarantee against potential conflicts of interest. You know, they're talking about having there be no deals for the duration of his presidency. There'll be no deals with foreign entities, but there'll be domestic deals and they'll be approved by the ethics guy. But he won't know anything about them unless he reads about them in the newspaper. I mean, it just feels like if this is a wall between his business and his public life. It's a very porous wall.
And you know who's paying for that wall, right?
Yeah, right. Mexico.
And that was another thing we learned. Actually, he acknowledged on Wednesday that Mexico, if Mexico is not paying for the wall now, taxpayers may pay for it now, but Mexico will eventually pay for it.
Yes. I mean, there was no more reliable applause line in his rallies than when he said, promised to build the wall, and then he'd ask the crowd, and who's going to pay for it? And they would all shout back, Mexico. So now what he's saying is that, well, he really wants to get started on the wall, and that the negotiations with Mexico to pay for it are going to take a year, year and a half. So we're going to go ahead and ask Congress for the money, have the United States taxpayers pay for the wall, and then Mexico will reimburse us. That's the way he squared the circle on that.
He also gave us two timetables, one on when the Republican Party will replace and repeal Obamacare, and also when he's going to name a new Supreme Court nominee.
Right. And, you know, the Obamacare thing was a little confusing to me, like the syntax was a little confusing. I think he was talking about how almost immediately after his HHS cabinet secretary, Tom Price, is confirmed, they will almost immediately, he said, put out their proposal to repeal and replace.
Yeah, that's what I heard, too.
But what I don't understand is whether what he was also saying was that the act of Congress that he wants is one that simultaneously repeals and replaces. Because there are a lot of Republicans who are nervous about the idea of voting for repeal without knowing what the replacement's going to be.
And the Supreme Court, right?
Right. And he sounds like he's going to move pretty quickly on the Supreme Court. My guess is that he probably want to get Jeff Sessions confirmed by the Senate first before he puts somebody out there. But yeah, that could come really quickly. And if there's anything that he can do that will have a huge and immediate effect, it's filling that vacancy on the Supreme Court.
There was also, this was surprising to me, there was also no mention of a timetable for the deportation of Meryl Streep.
Yeah. No, that really would have gotten a rise out of him if anybody had asked him about Meryl Streep. After she gave that anti-Trump speech at the Golden Globe Award ceremony the other night, he had quite a tweet attack on her about calling her one of the worst actresses in America.
Overrated.
Overrated. That's it. Overrated. Not that she was bad, just overrated.
Janet, I think the question that I want to ask you as we think of what happened on this very surreal Wednesday afternoon is, what's changed since the election?
Not Donald Trump, I'll tell you that. I mean, this press conference really answered for me a question that a lot of people have had, or that had from the time that he got his surprising victory, is saying, well, now that he's going to be president, maybe he'll chill out a little bit. Maybe he'll become more presidential. He'll become, you know, he'll send a message of bringing people together rather than dividing them. And this press conference, it was vintage Donald Trump. It was just like the Donald Trump that we saw in the campaign. And anybody who's expecting him to, A, stop tweeting, B, stop attacking the media, stop attacking his critics, it's just not going to happen. This is the real Donald Trump.
Janet Hook is a political reporter for The Wall Street Journal who, like many of us, watched Wednesday's Donald Trump press conference in awe and without blinking. Janet, thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
I live for the applause, applause, applause. I live for the applause, applause.
Donald Trump gets sworn in on Friday, January 20th, but the efforts to get his cabinet nominees confirmed are already underway, with the hope of having his administration in place by the inauguration. As for the Democratic opposition, the party still doesn't know what hit them. Out of power not only from the White House, but from both houses of Congress, they know they won't be able to stop his inauguration, but can they defeat any of his cabinet nominees or his choice to fill the Supreme Court vacancy? What exactly should they do or can do? Walter Shapiro is a columnist for Roll Call, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and a lecturer of political science at Yale University. Walter, welcome to The Political Junkie.
I'm a longtime fan, Ken, so I'm glad to do it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, and as am I.
Longtime fan, first time caller.
I love that. I don't know why they do that. They always say that. You know, we know that the Democrats thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. Many of them were sure that the Democrats were going to regain control of the Senate or they'd pick up a lot in the House. None of that happened. So the question is, where is the Democratic Party right now?
somewhere between a rock and a hard place, somewhere lost on the Garden State Parkway, I guess. I mean, the fact is, what is fascinating to me is that with all of these Trump cabinet nominees before the Senate or about to go before the Senate, they can't figure out which one to focus on. And what I suspect they're going to do, and Chuck Schumer has indicated that the real fire is going to be directed not at the Russian ties of Secretary of State designate Rex Tillerson, but the Medicare, Medicaid, and health insurance plans of Tom Price for Secretary of HHS. Because that allows the Democrats to trot out the rhetoric that they always trot out. It makes them feel so happy when they say this is a war against seniors or he wants to privatize Social Security.
But you know that there's a lot of issues, I mean, directed on Jeff Sessions, on race, for example, on Tillerson, on his ties with Russia, on Betsy DeVos and her feelings about public education. So there are a bunch of them, but you're saying that you think they're going to focus on maybe Price.
That would be my guess, just from public statements that Schumer has said. And I mean, but the point is, with Tillerson, it is telling that during Wednesday's hearing, the fiercest questioning came from a Republican, Marco Rubio.
Let me play some of that tape.
Is Vladimir Putin a war criminal?
I would not use that term.
Well, let me describe the situation in Aleppo, and perhaps that will help you reach that conclusion.
And then Rubio goes on to describe the carnage of Aleppo and Russia's involvement in the slaughter of thousands of civilians, and then he continues with this.
So, based on all this information, and what's publicly in the record about what's happened in Aleppo and the Russian military, you are still not prepared to say that Vladimir Putin and his military have violated the rules of war and have conducted war crimes in Aleppo.
Now, those are very, very serious charges to make, and I would want to have much more information before reaching a conclusion. I understand there is a body of record in the public domain. I'm sure there's a body of record in the classified domain, and I think in order to deal with a serious question like this,
Mr. Tillerson, what's happened in Aleppo is in the public domain. The videos and the pictures are there.
Fully informed before advising the president.
Well, I encourage you. There is so much information out there about what's happened in Aleppo, leaving the Chechen issue aside. What happened there is clearly documented as well. There's so much information out there. It should not be hard to say that Vladimir Putin's military has conducted war crimes in Aleppo, because it is never acceptable, you would agree, for a military to specifically target civilians, which is what's happened there through the Russian military. And, you know, I find it discouraging, your inability to cite that, which I think is globally accepted.
You know, Walter, it was surprising. I mean, we talk about what the Democrats were going to do to try to derail one or more of the Trump cabinet nominees, but here we have Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida.
Yeah, which is the fact that the Russian card, the Putin pivot by Trump, does leave a lot of anti-Russian Republicans, prominent Republicans like Rubio, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, a little, a gobsmacked, for want of a better word. In fact, it was interesting to me, if you're counting votes in the Senate, Trump went out of his way to ridicule Lindsey Graham standing in the presidential polls a year ago at Wednesday's press conference, which would not be the normal situation of an incoming president counting every Republican vote in the Senate.
Exactly. I mean, all they need to defeat it, let's just say for argument's sake that all 48 Democrats line up together, all you need are three Republicans to vote no, and a nominee could go down.
Oh, exactly. And I believe if Rubio voted no, they can't report it out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Let me pivot a little bit to Jeff Sessions, who's the nominee for Attorney General. He's the Republican senator from Alabama. And with Sessions, a lot of the complaints and debate is about race. Do you see the nomination in jeopardy at all?
With all nominations, you never know until the last minute what would come out. That said, it is a very high bar to not confirm an incumbent senator. I mean, the closest analogy we have was the very non-likable, semi-alcoholic John Tower, who was rejected as the first George Bush's defense secretary in 1989. But unlike Tower, Sessions is popular. And it's going to take a lot more than just regurgitating the 1986 hearings against him, where the Senate Judiciary Committee did not report him out for the federal bench to derail the Sessions nomination. And right now, I would think that of all the nominees, of the controversial nominees, Sessions, who made some alarming statements during his hearing on things like targeting the press and the Justice Department, I still see that he is probably the safest of the major Trump nominations.
Yeah, I kind of think that once we saw Susan Collins, who potentially would have been the only no vote among the Republicans on Sessions, and when she lauded him and praised him, you knew that it sounded like a done deal. So if the Democrats are unlikely to defeat any of the nominees, they're certainly not going to stop Trump's inaugural next Friday. What do you think their plans are? What do they hope to accomplish the following day on January 21st, the Women's March on Washington?
Well, I think what we have right now is you have all of this incoherent rage without a nominal outlet. I assume the Women's March on the 21st is not a protest for the actions that President Trump took starting at noon on the 20th. I mean, there is a sense that while there are many points, the Vietnam War was one example, where marches on Washington could signify massive changes in public opinion, Trump lost the popular vote. So and he particularly lost the popular vote along the East Coast. So the idea that hundreds of thousands of women from the East Coast will come to Washington, I just don't see how that adds anything that anyone in politics didn't know already to the calculus.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking of, as the Trump administration is about to start, I'm thinking of all this Democratic frustration that's out there, the Russian hacking of Democratic emails, the potential conflicts of interest for Trump and his family, a Supreme Court seat that they feel was stolen from them. And the Democrats don't even have a leader yet. They're still fighting to get a DNC chair, and that won't be until February. What can the Democrats do?
Well, right now, what the Democrats should do is, and I've written this, is they should look for issues where they have Republican allies of principle, which is why I think the Tillerson nomination is a much more fruitful place to fight than to have one more war on seniors, war on women, attack fest, no matter how justified, with Price and Sessions. The fact is that the most important thing is to, A, focus on those aspects of Trump that differ from a normal president, and relations with Russia would be a major one, and also to focus on those behavior aspects of Trump that differ from a normal Republican, such as his refusal in Wednesday's press conference to in any way, shape, or form even appoint an independent group of businessmen to run the Trump empire. The idea that the ethics police are going to be his two sons is just unfathomable and a violation of democratic norms. So, I mean, focusing on those issues strikes me as much more fruitful than just coming up with more talking points for your standard issue, democratic. The Republicans are opposing Medicare. They're opposing women's issues, which have mostly worked very badly for the Democrats in off-year congressional elections.
Walter Shapiro is a columnist for Roll Call. He's also a lecturer of political science at Yale University and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. He can be found on Twitter at Mr., that's M-R, M-R Walter Shapiro. M.R. Shapiro, it was great having you on the program.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the Twitter handle. This was fun.
Spirit of my silence, I can hear you, but I'm afraid to be near you, and I don't know where to begin, and I don't know where to begin. Somewhere in the desert, there's a forest, an acre before us, but I don't know where to begin, but I don't know where to begin. Again, I lost my strength completely.
President Obama said goodbye on Tuesday night. It was his farewell address, concluding his 8 years in the White House. Next Friday, January 20th, he will officially cede his title to Donald Trump. He gave the speech in Chicago, the same venue where he celebrated his re-election victory in 2012. It was a packed house, some 20,000 attendees, and it was a combination, here is my legacy, thank you for being part of it all, and don't ever stop fighting for what you believe. Paul Glastris is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. Paul, it's great to have you back on The Political Junkie.
Ken, it's great to be back.
There was a lot he packed into that speech. What were your first impressions?
Well, you know, we think of, you know, there's a handful of presidential farewell addresses that have come down to us, you know, in memory. Eisenhower's address, warning of the military-industrial complex, is the most recent that's memorable. George Washington's is the first and most important. There are not a lot of memorable ones. I think this might well be a very memorable one. My boss, Bill Clinton, gave one, and it was a summation of his philosophy of government and a quick recitation of his achievements, but it wasn't anything too spectacular. He gave it from the Oval Office. It was, very short. This was a rally, really. And what struck me was it was less a farewell address than a see you later address.
Yeah, you know something, that's actually a very good point. When I think of, and we're going to have a little segment about the Eisenhower farewell address later in the program, the famous military-industrial complex speech, but Eisenhower, like other presidents, just sat before a camera at the White House, gave his speech and left. I mean, this was an absolute, not only here's what I did for the past 8 years, but the fight is not over.
That's absolutely right. And he didn't say this, but I think from things we know, for instance, that President Obama has said he's going to support, maybe join the organization that his Attorney General Eric Holder is creating to work on redistricting issues and voter participation around 2020. That's a political enterprise. Past presidents have walked away from politics very consciously.
Think of George W. Bush after he left office, right?
Completely out of the public spotlight. But even, you know, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, they were public men. They created their own organizations, but they were international in scope, charitable in focus, really not focused on domestic policy, and certainly not focused on domestic politics.
Well, before we go on about the future of Barack Obama, let's go back to the past. His speech on Tuesday night, a lot of it was touting his successes. Let me play a piece of that tape.
If I had told you 8 years ago that America would reverse a great recession, reboot our auto industry, and unleash the longest stretch of job creation in our history, if I had told you that we would open up a new chapter with the Cuban people, shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program without firing a shot, take out the mastermind of 9/11. If I had told you that we would win marriage equality and secure the right to health insurance for another 20 million of our fellow citizens, if I had told you all that, you might have said our sights were set a little too high. But that's what we did.
That was what speechwriters call the litany. That's what you see in State of the Union addresses, where the president ticks off the achievements. I personally think Obama should have done more of that during his presidency. Bill Clinton was not afraid to report back to the American people what he had done. Obama was a little bit just shy to do that. I thought it was an interesting way of doing the litany, which is, if I had told you, we would have climbed out of the worst recession, saved the auto industry, killed bin Laden, et cetera. So it was brief, well wrought, and necessary.
I agree with you completely on this. There's something else I want to play. I mean, there's a bunch of things I want to play, but I thought this piece of tape was interesting. This is really trying to, well, setting up the transition with the 45th president. Let me play this tape.
In 10 days, the world will witness a hallmark of our democracy. No. The peaceful transfer of power from one freely elected president to the next.
You think of him tamping down the booze when obviously there's a reference to Donald Trump, and compare Donald Trump's reaction when the crowd yells, lock her up, when it's talking about Hillary Clinton. That was a striking difference, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, the differences between Barack Obama and Donald Trump will be more and more apparent to us as we go forward. In almost every way, they couldn't be more different. Barack Obama inhabited the role of president as much as any president has. He took the ceremonial role, for one, very, very seriously. He gave presidential addresses and mixed governing philosophy with values, with policy. Whether you liked the policy or not, they were almost uniformly well-wrought speeches in the great tradition of American presidencies. That's just not Donald Trump at all.
You know, as I said earlier in our conversation, that part of the speech was, here's what I've done for the past 8 years, as you call it, the litany, his legacy, I guess, and also what he may plan to do. He didn't really give us specifics, as you point out, but he did tell people not to sit back and be complacent. Let me play a little of that.
If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life. If something needs fixing, then lace up your shoes and do some organizing. If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself.
And then came the finale.
My fellow Americans, it has been the honor of my life to serve you. I won't stop. In fact, I will be right there with you as a citizen for all my remaining days. But for now, whether you are young or whether you're young at heart, I do have one final ask of you as your president. The same thing I asked when you took a chance on me 8 years ago. I'm asking you to believe, not in my ability to bring about change, but in yours. I am asking you to hold fast to that faith written into our founding documents, that idea whispered by slaves and abolitionists, that spirit sung by immigrants and homesteaders and those who marched for justice, that creed reaffirmed by those who planted flags from foreign battlefields to the surface of the moon. A creed at the core of every American whose story is not yet written. Yes, we can. Yes, we did. Yes, we can. Thank you. God bless you. May God continue to bless the United States of America.
You know, Paul, for much of the last 8 years, President Obama was derided as an intellectual, but there was a lot of guts coming out of him on Tuesday night, a lot of emotion.
No question about it. And these are points he's been saying since before he was elected. He's been consistent about it. I don't know of another president who more focused on the process of democratic organizing, the role of the public. I mean, Bill Clinton always gave credit to the American people for change. But Barack Obama, an organizer, has a kind of respect for the common man's ability to self-govern and be involved that is quite remarkable. And speaking of emotional, I don't know if you saw when he called out Michelle Obama and the crowd just roared and he kind of teared up there. It was very touching.
I agree with you. I thought that was the most emotional part of the speech. One quick question, though. You know, towards the end when he said, I won't stop, What do you think a post-president Barack Obama, what do you think his role will be?
I think it's, you know, remains to be seen. I can only guess. But as I said at the top of the hour, he's already said he's going to support Eric Holder in an organization to bring out voters and to, you know, increase voter participation. That is a direct involvement in the political process. And so whatever he does, it's going to be consistent with his presidency, consistent with the rhetoric you heard last night. But I think he's going to find a way to be very presidential and nonpartisan about it, and yet take the role, which no past president has done, of being the leader of his party and staying very much engaged as the leader of the Democratic Party. And if you think about it, who are the leaders of the party? It's no longer the Clintons. You know, Chuck Schumer will do his battle, but he's not quite a national leader in his bearing and so forth. It's not going to be Nancy Pelosi, though they are the leaders of the party in Congress. There aren't really elder statesmen other than it's going to be Barack Obama. And he can choose to stay in the background or he can choose to be in the foreground. And I think it's going to be closer to the foreground.
Paul Glastris is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. Paul, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you, Ken.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last person to chair the Democratic National Committee who in his or her career also served in the cabinet? The answer, Ron Brown. Elected DNC chair in 1989, he was still in the job when Bill Clinton, who was elected president in 1992, picked him as Commerce Secretary in 1993. Brown was killed in a plane crash in 1996, during a trade mission to Croatia. And the randomly selected winner is Jeffrey Sachs of Jerusalem, Israel. Who knew? Jeffrey wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
It's the end, friend of mine. It's the end, friend of mine. Time is over. Oh, we could simply say I love you. Now you open the door. Leave me crying, trying to embrace you again, trying to face this damn situation, man, I can't. It's the end.
Earlier in the program, we were talking about President Obama's farewell address that he gave on Tuesday evening. Most presidents do give farewell addresses, but history seems to remember only two. The one given by George Washington in 1796, where he warns of foreign entanglements, and the one given by Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1961, as he was leaving office after 8 years.
This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen.
There was a lot of uncertainty in the world as Ike gave that nationally broadcast speech in 1961. It's famously remembered for his warning against what he called the military-industrial complex. Stephen Hess is the senior fellow emeritus at Brookings Institution, but back then he was a speechwriter for Eisenhower. Steve, it's always great to have you on The Political Junkie.
What fun being here again.
Well, how much, in listening to Obama Tuesday night, how much of your time was spent thinking about Eisenhower's speech?
Well, I should start by saying that Obama's speech was 49 minutes and 55 seconds, so there was plenty of time to think about anything. Eisenhower's speech was 15 minutes and 43 seconds. They were very different speeches, and of course I was paying most attention, serious attention, to what the present president was trying to tell me. But nevertheless, your thoughts drift back to the Eisenhower speech and how very different they were, not only in terms of length, but the Eisenhower speech didn't mention any of his accomplishments. It wasn't about accomplishments. It was about something altogether different. So these two speeches had different reasons for being. Obviously, when Obama goes to the largest convention center in the United States and has 18,000 people in the audience, he's not going to give and doesn't plan to give the same sort of speech that Dwight Eisenhower had in the Oval Office, simply looking into one camera.
I also noticed that Eisenhower gave his speech in black and white. Now, what was that all about?
I had forgotten that. I'm not sure I even remembered at the time. Did we have color then?
Well, we didn't at all. Certainly not on television, that's for sure.
Not on television, right.
You first joined the White House speech team during the 1958 midterm election, that's correct?
That's correct.
Now, how much, I mean, I shouldn't really ask you this, but how much responsibility do you take for the Republicans' 47-seat loss in the House and 13 in the Senate that year?
Total response. No, I blew it all by myself.
You know, when I mentioned Eisenhower appearing in black and white, and I watched that speech this week, and I'd seen it before, but it was just remarkable because I watched it right after I watched President Obama. But back in 61, television was a fairly new medium back then, right? I mean, how would you assess Eisenhower's use of it? Of course, you know, you think of what Jack Kennedy did with television, but...
That's right. Eisenhower wasn't really made for giving speeches on television, and wasn't made for giving press conferences on television. However, he did, with his press conferences, allow television in for the first time, but not in until after he had given his press conference. But still, that was a breakthrough, having television there, even though the press conferences weren't live on TV. Eisenhower was simply born of another era. He was our oldest president at that time, and he was not an actor like Ronald Reagan. He wasn't made for television. But I think people rather appreciated the fact that he wasn't, the fact that it didn't all sound very polished. And of course, he was immediately followed by Jack Kennedy, who did allow the TV cameras in and was very good at it.
You mentioned that Eisenhower was the oldest president. I think when he left office in January of 1961, Eisenhower was younger than Donald Trump is today.
Yeah, that's right. He was 70 years old. Yeah, it is remarkable.
But one of the things that struck me the most is he was thankful for his ability to work together with Congress, which is not something we heard from President Obama on Tuesday night.
Of course, at that time, Congress, from his point of view, consisted of Sam Rayburn in the House and Lyndon Johnson in the Senate, both Texans. And I consider himself a bit of a Texan. And the three of them, although the congressional folks were Democrats and he were a Republican, got along just fine. Although even that is interesting. When he was writing his memoirs, the person who was working with him said that he had some very unhappy, very unfortunate things or unpopular things to say about Rayburn and Johnson, but he wouldn't say it. These were things that he kept to himself. His relations really remained very good.
Well, let's listen to Ike in his farewell address about that.
In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well. To serve the nation good, rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together.
Stephen Hess, somehow I didn't expect President Obama to talk about his gratitude regarding his relationship with Congress.
No, at least not for 6 years. Eisenhower's speech, which is, of course, as you pointed out, at play, was best remembered for the question of the military-industrial complex remark. But to me, that really wasn't what the speech was largely about. For those who read the speech, and again, it's not very long, it's really about balance. It's all about balance, about a balance that we have to maintain between national programs and local programs, between the elderly and the young, between our duties as individuals and as citizens. And that was pure Eisenhower. That was the beauty of the speech, which was, at least semi-philosophical, was about the balances of our lives and the balances as they relate to our government.
Well, let me cut to the most memorable part, as you just alluded to.
We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
We must guard against the military-industrial complex. Stephen Hess, tell me the origin of that phrase.
The thought behind it was pure Eisenhower. He really was concerned about the military, particularly the cost of the military, particularly the cost of the Air Force, and, of course, the lobbying that was going on to support that. In a strange way, you could almost say that Eisenhower had two great objectives, to keep the peace and to balance the budget. And what was going on with military spending really disturbed him in terms of balancing the budget. But the actual phrase was thought up. There were three in our team of speechwriters, Malcolm Moose, the chief speechwriter, and the assistant naval aide who wrote the national security things. His name was Ralph Williams. It was actually his phrase. And what made it, of course, Eisenhower had to talk about the military. He had to talk about the industrial. What he needed was that third word to put it together, complex. And that just came to Ralph one day as he was writing, as these things often happen. We start a sentence, and before you know it, it's complete. And of course, he doesn't get any credit for it. Nobody even remembers his name, Ralph Williams. And partly because under Eisenhower, we really strongly had a sense that we didn't tell tales out of school. That was poor form. None of the credit claiming that subsequent president speechwriters went through was true of the Eisenhower group.
Well, how is Eisenhower's reference to the military-industrial complex, how was that received at the time?
Well, I think it was received at the time, though over time it had taken up a view of really being anti-war. Perfect that it fitted into to the Vietnam era and so forth. And I really don't think that's what he was talking about at the time. At any rate, it certainly became the best remembered phrase of the 8-year Eisenhower presidency. And again, just Google it and you'll find it's one of the highest referenced remarks of any president.
At the time, was it seen as an anti-military thing or a curb on military power? I mean, after all, he was a general in the Army.
Yeah, that was really it. That's what etched this thing in the public mind. This wasn't just coming from anybody. It wasn't coming from a Bill Clinton or, you know, who tried to stay out of the military or that sort of thing. It had come from a man who was a 5-star general, the hero of a just war. So it was truly noted.
You know, he doesn't get great grades from most historians. How would you rate him?
That's an interesting question. I was one of the participants in Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s poll of presidents that came out in the New York Times in 1997, and he rated pretty low. There have been polls since then, and each poll he rates higher and higher and higher till, you know, he's suddenly up there at least at ninth. And then he had been maybe 20th. So history is starting to remember him with much more goodwill. Of course, that always depends on what happens afterwards, not on what he did, but what we went through after that period. And in retrospect, he can look pretty good.
How do you personally rate him?
The categories are usually great, near great, so forth and so on, down to failing. I would rate him as a high of the second category. He's not going to replace Washington, Lincoln, or Franklin Roosevelt, but he's sure going to press up against Teddy Roosevelt and maybe Andrew Jackson.
How would you rate the Political Junkie podcast?
It's superb. Everybody knows that.
Steve, that was the right answer. Stephen Hess is a senior fellow emeritus at Brookings Institution and a veteran presidential historian and speechwriter, going back to Dwight David Eisenhower. Steve Hess, a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much. Have a very good year.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you. Lay your body.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you. Lay your